Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a fortnightly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And this week we've got Pete Baumgartner with us from Lincoln Loop. Hello, Pete. Thank you for coming on the show.
Hello. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So, Pete, we've got so much to talk about. We talk about Lincoln Loop. We talk about things like high-performance Django, deployment, topics like that. But we always ask, how did you get started and how did you find Django? Like, what's your backstory? Like,
yeah. Let's see. I'll try to keep it short, but graduated college with a computer science degree right at the beginning of the dot-com bust, the original dot-com bust in the 2000s.
Good timing.
Moved to the mountains and was a ski bum for a couple of years, and then I got into doing some computer stuff, like computer repair and like kind of small business networking stuff. And from that, folks, there was a really there's somebody doing kind of website and emails, email hosting in our town that would go on vacation. And I think they ran a server out of a closet or something, and the server would die and people wouldn't have an email for 2 weeks while he was on vacation. And so, you know, people started asking us, hey, can you help us out with your email? And kind of figured out email. And then with that came websites. And so picked up PHP and WordPress and got into that. And kind of painted myself into a corner a couple of times trying to build WordPress plugins for things that should have been much more than that. And had tried, picked up Ruby on Rails and all that, and eventually came to Django. And that was like, that was running off of the Subversion trunk days, pre 0.96.
I've been using Django for a long time, you know, like version 1.1, something around that kind of time. And you've sort of always been on the landscape. You know, Lincoln Loop was one of the first agencies that I knew about that were blogging about Django and using it. And
it worked out really well. And, you know, I was just blogging about my experience, you know, learning the framework and using it and all that. And it turned out the things that were stumbling blocks for me were stumbling blocks for lots of other people. So, got some traction on that and did a kind of a lightning talk at, I think it was the first DjangoCon. It was at Google, and their Mountain View campus, on some like customizations to the admin I had done, which really were not that, like, it was kind of like some, you know, injecting some CSS in and stuff. And people were like, you know, mind blown. Like, it was not, it was just early days, you know, people hadn't kind of thought of it yet. So, really feel like, in the right place at the right time type situation, you know.
Do you recall why Django over, you know, Rails, especially at the time, would have been the obvious other choice?
The documentation was a big deal for me. And I think I liked Python's, you know, people say Python, there should be, you know, kind of one right way to do it. And that worked in my head better than where I think Ruby is. Like, there's a lot of different ways to do it, and, you know, use your creativity and all that. I think that was harder for me to kind of wrap my head around. So, but the documentation definitely was huge as well.
That makes sense. Well, because it's easy to think about now versus back then, whereas now Python is much more broadly used than Ruby. Ruby is pretty much predominantly used with Rails, but back then it was, you know, not so much the case. I mean, it was probably a number of years later, I think it was 2012, when I was deciding which of the two to play around with, and Rails had better beginner materials, and there were more, I was in San Francisco at the time, more startups using it, but I just picked Django for some reason. I think because I just knew I had to pick one and go deep on it rather than bouncing around. Whereas now I think it's, hopefully with my stuff and others, there's more content for Django beginners, but it definitely felt 8 years ago like your average Django person was coming in with, you know, if not a CS degree, knowledge of Python. Whereas if you were, you know, all the boot camps were Rails. Like, I think all the boot camps now are pure JavaScript pretty much, but they still basically don't do Django at all. They, if they do have batteries included, it's Rails to this day.
Yeah. And I think I kind of, part of the reason Lincoln Loop started was I think I kind of saw like there was a lot of Rails specific agencies out there at the time, people focusing on it. And I saw, you know, Django seemed like it was a couple of years behind Rails, and figured, you know, hey, maybe you can get in now and beat the crowd.
Can you talk about so Lincoln Loop, so building out that agency, and you know, the type of client work you've done over the years and how that's developed?
So started, you know, like I said, I was doing business with kind of these small business networking and things like that, and kind of dabbled in the website stuff. And then I was working for another company and got more interested in the website stuff and sort of spun out a little business there. And eventually we just kind of didn't see eye to eye anymore. They saw it as kind of a value add on for their services, and I was more interested in building kind of a standalone agency. So we parted ways. But at the time, all my clients were local. I was just freelancing, a lot of website hosting stuff and supporting, you know, people setting up Microsoft Outlook for their emails and all that. And got involved with a couple of real estate companies here, and was kind of frustrated with the state of the world of real estate search. So that was kind of my first big project I built in Django, and built a bunch of tooling around that. Actually had a little product that I was kind of operating for a while. And that was where I started blogging about it and kind of shifted gears of my company from being we build kind of brochure WordPress sites for local businesses to, you know, we're focused on Django and all that. And honestly, like the phone just started ringing. It was kind of shocking to me. I remember like one day I got I don't think that people were calling me directly, but, you know, getting an email, got an email from National Geographic, and they're like, you know, hey, we're looking at moving to Django. And, you know, I'm like working out of a spare bedroom at the time, you know, all by myself. And, I was like, yeah, you know, and so pretty quickly had more business than I could handle on my own. And, at the time, it was really easy to find Django developers that wanted to work professionally. Like, people were working with Django and their, you know, personal projects and on the side, but there wasn't a whole lot of professional opportunity around it. So, I was able to kind of just go through the open source community and start picking people out. Like, hey, I've seen you, you know, I've used some of your software. Do you want to work on Django stuff? And they're like, yeah, great. I'd love to. I'm, you know, doing PHP stuff or working in Plone or whatever. So people kind of jumped at the opportunity.
But that's such a good story about, like, you know, from the sort of business perspective of finding a niche, because, you know, perhaps a year or two in front of where I was in terms of timeline, but I had that same phenomenon of living in a world where it was a WordPress and, you know, setting up emails and managing domains. And it's kind of all, it was really hard to make a living in that world, because it was all low value, low margin, difficult stuff. And then finding the way into, for me, it was native app development, but, you know, as well as Django, I did build apps and then used Django for the back end. But finding into the way into a niche where it's like, actually, there's loads of air here. There's loads of air around. And then there's lots of clients who are desperate. And it's like, all of a sudden, this is a really sustainable business.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there have definitely been, kind of peaks and valleys. And it was a long time before...
Yeah, you're always looking for work.
...made the leap to paying people full time. It was always contract work and per project. And then I kind of looked around and, you know, we all realized, like, I've basically been paying you full time for 3 years, you know, because there hasn't been a gap. Then making that transition. But
that transition, that must have come from ongoing business, like maintenance of ongoing projects and things, right? So you've got regular clients that you know are going to pay
there
the bills every month.
Not as much then. Like, I think we have more of it now. It was more kind of back-to-back projects, and that was stressful because you don't know when the next one's going to come.
Because if it stops, I remember there was an agency in Barcelona that won all sorts of awards. They were doing like Facebook's app, and they won, you know, they were up on stages and all the big things. And, you know, they were like, wow, everyone was watching them. And all of a sudden they just disappeared because, I don't know, the work dried up for 3 months and they had 50 developers on.
That terrifies me. That end of business, kept me up at night for, you know, a few years in the beginning.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, as we were growing, like I had a line of credit with the bank that was, I can't remember if it was attached to our house or a car or something, and like completely draining it every month to cover paying people while I waiting for, you know, checks to come in from, you know, we were profitable, but just the kind of cash flow wasn't there yet. We didn't have a you know, buffer. And that was, I'm glad we're not there anymore. It's stressful.
But I mean, interesting to hear, you know, you, from a business point of view, like your story, and it's, you know.
I think there's three main things to talk about. Your high performance Django book, deployments, and then App Pack. And maybe I'll put it to you. Which, how do you string those together? Because we've sort of been circling around it, but deployments and maintaining a site anywhere, but especially with Django, is non-trivial.
Yeah.
And you've done a lot of work on this.
Yeah. So I think one of the challenges of being, you know, I don't want to say like a front runner, but like earlier in the game, some of these stories weren't as well defined as, you know, how do you set up a site that's, you know, getting millions of page views a day and all that. We definitely did some learning by trial and error, and there was some good information out there. I remember at the time, the guy that does Sentry, he was working at like chess.com or something. I can't remember where it was. He gave a talk about like scaling Django, and this was really early on. David Kramer.
Is chess.com Django?
I'm probably butchering the story. I can't remember what it was, where he was working. This was, long time ago, but yeah, you know, so there were some people doing it, but it just wasn't kind of common knowledge at the time. And, I think it was sort of piecing stuff together from what other people had learned doing Rails and all that. So, we did one large site that was like a gaming publication, and it was like a CMS, and like they had a little social network built in and stuff. And they would do these like drawings, like first comment gets, you know, like a free such and such. So they would like post something on their site, and like immediately, like it would just go bananas. And it was not just people like reading the site. It was like people trying to type in comments and stuff. So, we learned a lot, through, you know, kind of trial by fire there. And, I think the book came about, we had a client that we worked with who was, you know, large, another large CMS company. And, they had a bunch of really smart devs on their staff, and, you know, they came to us and said, hey, you know, we've got this scaling problem, and our sites, you know, periodically go down, and we're really lost here. We're just stuck. Like, we just could use another set of eyeballs. And they kind of explained their system and how it's working and all that. And I'm like, gosh, like, this isn't the way you should be doing it, you know? Like, and it was like,
where to start?
you kind of get those sometimes where it's like, you know, they've cobbled this system all together, and it's like, the system is not working well. Can you help us fix this system? When really the solution is like, you should probably burn that thing to the ground and do it a different way.
For sure.
You know, of course you're going to have problems like this with the system. So I kind of was doing a write-up for the client on sort of, you know, our recommendations on how to proceed. And, I think like, and not to like, I hate it when people are like, oh, these people are idiots or whatever. Like, they were really smart people. And I think, you know, they made some early on architecture choices that probably made sense at one point that, you know, they carried on for a long time. So, I think, you know, it's easy to come in hindsight and say like, oh, that's all wrong. But, at the time, I think, you know, things made sense, but as I was kind of doing the write up for them, you know, the words were just like flowing, like it was really easy. I was like, I should, you know, I could probably write more on this. And so I'm pretty sure I was coming back from a conference or something and sat down in the airplane and wrote like 5,000 words on, you know, like how to set up scaling and how this should be done or whatever. And it's like, all right, I could probably do a book out of this. And so I,
about that time you were doing a newsletter as well, right? You would do it. There was a Lincoln Loop update or a Friday, like there was an email.
Yeah, we've gone through a couple of, yeah, we had like a podcast and we had a newsletter where we were like collecting kind of like links that I think Jeff Triplett's got something going with that now, but.
Yeah, with Will.
Yeah.
I'm just however many years behind you.
No, it's pain, like it's hard. Like I was doing that, the newsletter thing, mostly on my own. I just got sick of it. But
I think a partner really helps because like for the podcast, for the newsletter, even this awesome Django repo that I have that has, I don't know, 3,000 stars. Like actually Jeff came on to that because I was basically ready to just be like, I can't like, so, and I, you know, having a couple of weeks where you can just be like, I'm just not, especially when you're not really, you know, you're not really getting paid for it. So it's the easy to drop.
That's nice.
But I didn't know you had that, but it makes sense because I think there isn't a Django thing, which is why Jeff and I started that. And I think barely we have ads, which covers the cost of the Rails app that we use to host it, so it's not a, you know, it's for the community.
Yeah totally.
The Django forum is a Rails app as well, right? Because that's Discord. So the whole Django ecosystem built on
Rails. Well, because Jeff and I got some emails from people saying, hey, how come you're using a Rails site for this? And it's like, well, if you saw that it was a Rails site, you would have seen that it's also a company. And, you know, yeah, we could have built it, I guess. But you know, I don't need to build everything myself.
Yeah, totally.
Sorry, so I interrupted because I was having reminiscences about like the time because I got the high performance Django the second it was out. I was like, but hang on, I heard about that on your email and you were.
Oh yeah, totally.
So you were on the plane, you knocked out 5,000 words. You thought, yeah, I'm going to do that.
It was a Kickstarter too, right? I think.
Yep. So I kind of was like, all right, I should make sure people are going to want this before I, you know, kill myself writing the rest of it. So put it up on Kickstarter and the Kickstarter did well. And I think the only reason it got finished was because of the Kickstarter. Cause the first 5,000 words were really easy and, you know, it was relatively easy. Some of the other stuff, but there was a lot of stuff that was, you know, where it's like, I'm pretty sure this is the right way to do it, but now I really need to, like, you know, if I'm going to write it in a book, like I really need to figure it out. And so, you know, going through and testing stuff and then parts where, you know, I was a little fuzzy and I needed to lean on some of the other people we work with. It just got grueling towards the end. And I hear a lot of people that have, you know, published a book say this. So I really think the only reason it got completed was I had taken people's money and committed to a date that it was going to be done. And so it was like, all right, I have to do this. And this part of the reason I haven't ever finished a second version. I've tried to pick it up a couple of times and, I get through some of it and I'm like, I think I have PTSD or something from the first time. I can't force myself to sit through it. You know, like you were saying, you know, talking about deployment, I think one of the realizations as we were writing that was that book is not terribly Django specific. A lot of the things in it are kind of common deployment scenarios. You know, you've got a caching layer in front of some app servers and a database and, you know, you cache some database queries and that's the general architecture. And I think that's the thing that when we, you know, did this consulting job that it was missing. It was like they cobbled these other pieces together. And so I think that's where I started getting more into being interested in deployment and kind of configuration and all that. And these days I don't really do much Django development at all. I'm kind of more focused on, running servers and, you know, doing deployments and Docker and containers and all this fun stuff. which is a little weird because it's kind of full circle from where I
where you started with the email.
in some ways. So that's so one thing I wanted to mention with the book is so we originally put it out in, I can't remember if it's 2015 or 2017, but it's a few years old now. I think I still stand by a lot of the information in it, but there is some stuff in there that's outdated, either, you know, packages we were using that aren't around anymore. And like I said, I've been hoping to do a new revision of it, and it just hasn't come to fruition yet. So we're actually working with somebody now to get a free version of it published online. You'll just be able to read read it on the website. So I'm hoping that'll happen in the next month or two. And then I have not wanted to sell it anymore because I don't feel great that it's, you know, outdated, but I also don't want to just throw it in the garbage because I feel like there's still a lot of valuable information in there. So this seemed like it's run its course, you know, and seemed like a good way to kind of partially sunset it, I guess.
Well, no, it's cool. I mean, go on.
I just gonna say, when I read it, I think part of the reason why much of it still holds merit is, you know, you wrote it at a level up from, as I recall, there wasn't a ton of like code samples. It was really more like, as you said, this is how you construct it, and these are the tools. So even when so that has longevity as opposed to like for me, like I have to every 9 months update my code snippets, right. Which is like, you know, if they didn't sell, I definitely wouldn't do it. So, I appreciate when I read it that you wrote it at that level, because I think that is, especially with deployment, it is something where the big topics are kind of the same. And as I recall, like I think the two big things you said is basically database hits hurt you and, you know, cache all the things. And then you broke down the steps. And the second half, I think, is when you got more into like Nginx and like the server itself, because this is pre-platforms. Or I appreciate you didn't mention Heroku or any sort of hosted service in the book.
No. And yeah, we were kind of doing all, you know, stuff on a Linux server. Like it could be on AWS, but it wasn't, you know, serverless or, you know, on some other platform. But I've always felt like that stuff's great for people that, you know, need to do all sorts of weird custom stuff. But Heroku and the like are really the place to be for your kind of average person to even, you know, running a business or whatever. Most people are not Google scale companies and don't need to operate as if they were, you know.
Carlton, what were you going to say? You had something you're going to add there.
I was going to say about the book and the patterns in it. There was another one, a Riley one that, you know, I have on the shelf somewhere, but I can't remember the name of it right now, but it was the same. The examples were using MySQL and PHP or something like that, but it was the same patterns, you know. It's the, you know, the write through cache, that, you know, the database, optimize that, scale it out, have a read replica if you can, or, you know, these kind of things, which are exactly as you said, kind of implementation agnostic. It doesn't matter whether you did it in Django or Rails or, you know, Elixir or whatever, you're going to have the same problems.
Right. Yeah. I totally agree. Yeah. Your application is this, you know, your application, your database are the slowest parts of whatever you're doing. And the more you can avoid touching those things, the better off you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to reference, you gave a 2015 talk on Django deployments done right, which I watched before this, and we'll put a link to that. That covered a lot of best practices. Because I was thinking about that company because I'm wearing a Quizlet shirt. I worked at this company, Quizlet, that's now grown. And, you know, so why do companies get themselves in this holes of technical debt? You know, it's partly because they didn't know any better. But it's also partly because, like, they've got their own fires to deal with. So it's like, even though it takes extra time, it's like, no one has time to spend a couple of weeks, even if they have the expertise to like build, you know, burn it down, which is sort of why consultants are great, because, you know, you don't usually just sit there with nothing to do in a company unless you're going out of business, and then you got all the time in the world to refactor until you lose all your customers.
Right. Yeah. And I think people, you know, I think in the talk, I kind of hit on it a little bit, but I think people forget about the human cost of all of this.
Yeah. Like,
if you put, you know, yeah, you're running a million miles an hour and you don't have time to optimize your deployment process, but if your site's going down half the time you're deploying and your team is like, you know, totally stressed about it and, you know, constantly like waiting for the next fire to happen, like you're going to get burnout. People are going to leave. Like people can't do that for a sustained amount of time. And kind of looking at how do you give people a calmer, safer environment? And there's benefits to both sides on that. You know, like there's surely if your site goes down, that's an expense on the business side. But it's also, you know, taking a toll on your team. And I think making that stuff so it's not stressful. It's not, you know, like a, oh God, like my hands are sweating moment. Yeah. When you push that button to deploy is huge. And I know I've been there. Like I've been in those situations where it's like, this is terrifying. I just waiting for something to topple over when I push this button, you know?
It's when you put off deploying. You're like, you've got a fix and you're like, oh, we won't deploy that yet. And it's right. No. You can't be in that position. You've got to, if you've got a fix, you've got to be able to get it out. Like,
Yeah. Well, it's a bit like test coverage too, because, you know, the business can kind of carry on for a while, but it is, you know, burnout, people will quit, like, and then, yeah.
Totally. Yeah. There's, like day one, there's very little value in running tests, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the value comes 2 years down the road when somebody has to refactor or upgrade and like they can do it with some peace of mind versus, you know, having to go through and click everything or whatever. Yeah, I think that's like a savings account, you know?
Yeah.
you pays off later.
Well, I think if you're not technical, I mean, so I went to business school and I talked sometimes to a lot of these people go in and are PMs at companies. And so they're not technical. And, you know, in a crunch, they basically learn that if, you know, developers will say it takes 4 weeks and they'll crack the whip and say, well, get it done in 2 weeks. And so developers will ship something that looks like it works in 2 weeks. And the takeaway is the PM is like, oh, I just got to crack the whip on these lazy developers. And developers are like, that was terrible. There's no test coverage. I'm only doing that a couple times and I'm going to leave. So they both feel like they won, but the company's lost. So I always try to tell the non-technical people, like, you got to build in overflow for testing, deployments, you know, because I know you can't see it and it makes you sound good to your boss, but you're killing your team here. So if you want them to stay around for more than a year, you need to, you know, do something different. Even just like psychologically, like with, especially with testing or bugs in particular, like having like a bug squash day. Like at Quizlet, we would have it once a month. We'd have a day dedicated to bugs. So that let the PM offload the hierarchy to the developers. It wasn't just like, I'm saying no all the time. It was like, okay, I'm going to clear the overhead space and then you need to prioritize. And then, you know, and then you have fun with it instead of just like this endless queue of, you know, these bugs, these tests, these deployments. Right. So there's also like a psychological part to it all.
Right. And yeah, that's it's hard to make the business case on that sometimes. We deal with that with our clients. You know, they may not see it immediately, but you have to explain. You know, yeah, it's important that you upgrade this library. And, you know, even we're going to spend 10 hours on it, and your site's going to work just like it did before.
Exactly.
You know?
The same.
How about how's that sound to you?
Right.
I feel like every week on the podcast I say the same thing, but it's like taking your car to the garage to get it serviced, right? You change the oil, you change the brakes, you change the tires, you put new wash in the wipers, the car drives the same, but you wouldn't not do that.
Right.
And
I feel like it's an unfortunate, I don't know if software development, I guess maybe it's a remnant of software now being on the public internet, but it's unfortunate that you can't build something and just let it sit for 10 years and know that it's going to run 10 years later. You know, like the bit rot is a really weird thing that you build something and then you set it aside and 5 years later, you know, a year later, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. Well, there was an example this week of the Python cryptography package. They've upgraded and they, you know, they're bringing in Rust to make it memory safe. I mean, it's cryptography. You want memory safety. But, you know, there's people on, I know, Ubuntu 18 that doesn't have the right version of pip installed. And so, you know, the install breaks. It's like, you know, there was a big fallout. And all they did was make their package better.
Right.
I feel like it's, you know, when people rage quit tech, they often become like, you know, woodworkers or something totally analog where things don't need changing. But the antidote is I try to tell myself, well, what about like a chef? A chef makes something, it's literally gone in 20 minutes, you know? So, you know, on the spectrum of things, like it does last a while, you know? But yeah, you need to have like offline things that you do. So deployments, let's talk about AppPack. Because this is something new that you've just, I think, just publicly announced, right? Can you say what this is?
Yeah. Actually, your segue is kind of good. I'll jump ahead of myself a little bit. The one of the things. So all our clients are on AWS, either Heroku or AWS for the most part. And one of the really cool things I think about AWS is how stable their APIs are. I think, you know, you could probably write something in Boto or Boto 3, and assuming you could still get, you know, that version of Python to run, like it'll probably work in a few years, maybe 5 years. And I don't think you get that same kind of guarantee with other stuff. You know, if we used SaltStack as a configuration management tool in the past, and, you know, upgrades were always kind of scary. It's like the surface area is so big, what's going to break? It's kind of hard thing to test, you know? So I've kind of over the years transitioned from writing, you know, building and deploying sites as if they're on a Linux server and that Linux server could be anywhere, to taking more advantage of the, you know, I think the term these days is like cloud native, you know, like AWS specific tools, or if you're on GCP or Azure or whatever, they've got some pretty nice stuff there. Like we've been using RDS, Amazon's database service, for a long time, and that's amazing. Like I would gladly pay extra money for them for me to never have to think about a database again. Like I don't have to worry about backups or, you know, upgrades or whatever. Like it's just taken care of, and that's huge. Like I'm happy to run stateless services that, you know, like it's okay if the app crashes or goes away, like we can get it going again. But losing data is a different story. We've kind of been slowly transitioning from this like configuration management on Linux servers type scenario to more kind of cloud native stuff, and using a fair amount of Amazon ECS, which is their container service. It's sort of like Kubernetes. I'm not a huge fan of Kubernetes myself, just because we don't operate at a scale where I think Kubernetes is really valuable. You know, even our clients that get, you know, millions of page views a day, they're running like one or two apps, you know. We've got multiple environments for them, but they're not running 100, 1,000 apps or, you know, different projects. So for us, I don't think Kubernetes makes a ton of sense. And I sort of like, Docker was a tough one for me. You know, it's another kind of layer of abstraction, but there's value there in being able to bundle your application and getting it out onto servers. And Amazon ECS kind of lets you do that same thing as Kubernetes and just say, hey, I've got this image, just run it. I don't care where it runs or how it runs or whatever. Just, you know, make sure it has this much CPU and RAM and run it somewhere, which I think matches the mindset of kind of how most developers want to work on projects. Like I need this much RAM for this thing and just run it. Like, I don't care where it runs. I don't want to have to secure it. I don't want to have to deal with any of that. But like Amazon's stuff is I think their backwards compatibility is sometimes like a blessing and a curse. Like some of it just feels really archaic, and like the amount of hoops you have to jump through to kind of glue these services together or even figure out which services to glue together is non-trivial. Like you need to, it's now a whole nother thing you need to know, you know, like before it was like, okay, I know PHP and I can figure out like an Apache configuration and I can, you know, FTP something to a server and run it. And then it was kind of like, all right, now I need to know Linux and, you know, now I need to know.
Yeah, everything but your app
configuration
itself.
Management tools. Like, yeah, it's gotten bigger and bigger. And like AWS was just like another one you had to add on.
So extra layers of VPCs and security groups.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, ah.
Totally. So we built out a couple of solutions for clients based around Amazon ECS. And I still felt like, you know, this is just, it's too hard. Like it's too, you know, I've got my head wrapped around it, but trying to pass this off to somebody else who's focused on Python or JavaScript development, like good luck, you know, like not that it's like, you know, you need to be really smart to do it, but it's just like a lot of stuff you need to know. And it makes sense once you know it, but it's too much. So anyhow, that's where kind of AppPack came from. And I think I started it when COVID hit and I was like kind of stuck in the house. And it's like, you know, I think I can glue some of these things together and make this work a little easier. And always kind of having in mind, like Heroku does this really well. And I would tell anybody, like, if you fit the Heroku model, like use Heroku, they're great. Like that's the general, you push your code, they figure out like, yeah, it's Python, and they put it on a server and you don't have to worry about.
They put it on an Amazon stuff. Server.
Right, exactly. but for some of our clients, Heroku doesn't work out well. Like it's either expensive. They don't have all the service. You know, you can get your app running and Postgres and Redis, and I think that's it that Heroku itself offers. So if you want Elasticsearch, you got to go someplace else and get it.
Yeah.
And you have to run that traffic over the public internet, and you know, you have to trust some third party with your data, or you have to go to AWS and set it up yourself.
By the time you're doing that, you might.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, like trying to figure out if I could sort of glue these things at Amazon together, which are lower level, and make something that operates for the developers more like Heroku. And if you look at the services Amazon offers, and you kind of, you know, Amazon.com is built on Amazon, right? So Amazon uses Amazon Web Services internally, and you kind of start to see like, okay, like if I was going to build like a microservices version of a platform as a service, all the microservices you need are there. You know, it's got a way to store secrets. It's got a database. It's got a way to run containers. It's got load balancers. So AppPack was just kind of a way to glue those things together and sort of spackle over all the extra knowledge you need. You know, 90% of the time, everybody's going to set it up the same way. If you want to like follow best practice or whatever. So that's what I've been working on. I started, I guess, last May. And so our site runs on it, but that's not really that exciting. It's pretty trivial.
Yeah, but at least you're dog fooding. That's the important thing, right?
Yeah. And we have a couple of clients using it, and we're rolling it out to a larger client this month, and kind of just trying to work out any kinks or, you know, figure out what doesn't click for people. We've been rolling it out to kind of some individuals as well. So the way it works is you bring your own Amazon account. But we kind of give you all these tools that set it up in the right way for you, and your data, your app all run in your account, and you can have your controls on that. And we kind of just run. So we built a bunch of CloudFormation templates, which is like Terraform. It lets you set up a bunch of resources there. And we have a CLI and a web dashboard and an auth service that, auth service. And then we have something that plugs into Amazon Event Bridge, which lets us get notifications on what's happening in your environment and then kind of figure out what needs to be done and send the right AWS API calls to keep things moving along. So an example would be like, you know, you set up a project, you push your code, a build triggers. When the build finishes, then that sends a signal that says, hey, this build was successful. And our code can say, okay, now we need to figure out if there's a release task like Django migrations that need to run. And if you define that, then we kick off a task in ECS that runs your migrations. And then if those run successfully, then we kick off a deployment that updates your site. And like that kind of stuff that seems like it should be really easy and trivial is like actually kind of challenging in AWS and in kind of eventually consistent container land and all that. So we kind of take that off of people's hands.
So it sounds like this isn't necessarily Django specific, though obviously you've optimized it for Django. Is it currently, or do you have plans for it to be, you know, Rails or whatever language framework?
It is. So it's really cool. There's a project out there called BuildPacks, cloud native BuildPacks. And that's, I think originally it spun out of Heroku, but a bunch of other systems are using it now. I think Google Cloud Run uses it. I can't remember. A bunch of other people use it. And so you can use all of Heroku's build system. Well, not all of it, but like a lot of it's been open source. So you just define, well, it can go in and detect what your app is if it's a simple app. So if it goes in and sees a requirements.txt file, it'll say, oh, this is Python. If it sees package.json, it'll say, oh, this is Node. And it'll build kind of following best practice and in a generally sane way. So we're using that. So yeah, it's totally, I think there's 8 different languages that Heroku's build packs support. And there's other kind of like Google has their own build packs. I think the Cloud Foundry has some build packs out of their own, but Heroku's, some of them don't support Python. Heroku's does, so that's.
So it's like a build pack is like an alternative way of building a container, right? Than say a Docker file.
Yeah, so you don't need to write a Docker file, but you get a Docker compatible image out of the other end. And I think that's like just another example of like this balloon of knowledge that you need to have. Like the fact that people need to understand Docker and how to write a Docker file to be able to deploy an app is crazy to me.
Yeah.
This kind of manages that for you without you needing to have Docker on your machine and no Docker. You can use it if you want, but you don't have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds so nice. I mean, so my third book, The Professionals One, uses Docker, and writing it was a challenge to make it accurate but simple. And I get so many Docker questions, and it's hard to, because I wanted it to be, I do think Docker is very common, and also because Mac, Windows, whatever system, it's helpful that for me, I can just write the same thing, though, of course, there's been some Docker Windows stuff. Anyways.
I think it's Docker Mac stuff now, no?
Well, no, there was something, I guess it was earlier last year where like Docker Windows broke, yeah. Anyways, I was like, of all the, you know, I'm using Docker for it to be the one true thing, and it breaks for a while. But it is a total, I don't like, as a content creator, I don't like just being like, yeah, you need this. Here's like a couple paragraphs. Just run this Docker file and don't peek under the hood. You know, it's like a million lines of go, yeah. And it works until it doesn't. And when it doesn't, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we deal with that. We, you know, a lot of our client projects, there's, I don't know, maybe 50-50 of folks at Lincoln Loop that develop locally with Docker. And if you're hopping from project to project, it's a kind of a godsend. that you know you can just jump on another project and do Docker Compose up and things just work.
Or a team setting, for sure.
Yeah. But if you're working in the same project day in and day out, and you know how to set up your own machine, it can be a real hassle. Like, it gets in the way. It's slow. It's especially on Mac, where you're like under the hood, there's a Linux virtual machine that's running everything, and how are you the way it shares files across that is kind of weird, and the networking stuff's kind of weird, and just throwing it at somebody and say like, oh yeah, just use Docker, you'll be fine. Like, that's a big leap right there.
That's what I do. It works out okay, but yeah, I agree. I mean, it would be nice if, as programming develops, we had more simplicity of tools. I mean, we do. We have things packaged together like AppPack, but it also seems like the bigger ecosystem of what you need to know grows, right? Because people ask me, like, how do I learn how to program? It's like, okay, well, HTML, CSS, databases, SQL, Python, JavaScript, I was like, and that's just to get started. And then you can try my beginner's book. Right. I wish there was what is that balance, right? And then Docker, yeah, and all these things come on. And it just seems like it's sort of people just learn it as they need it, but they just kind of like band-aids, right? No one really has the time or the resources to like fully understand Docker, fully understand, whatever the tooling, because there's so much tooling. But anyway, so that's why, especially with deployment, something like AppPack, Heroku, Button, which Carlton's working on, these tools make all the sense in the world. I mean, personally, like, I have no interest in ever spinning up a Linux box. Like, I never want to do that ever.
Yeah.
The issue with spinning up a Linux box is, what do you do when you've spun it up? It's like, well, it's got nothing on it, so you've got to install it, and you don't want to do that.
Yeah, and then I feel like you end up in the same place there as like with the testing thing. Like,
yeah,
sure, you can spin it up and you can like manually install all your packages, like assuming you know how to do all this stuff, and like get it running. What happens when you now need to, you want to get a new version of Python, and it's not easily installable on your system. And, how do you move all that stuff? How do you manage upgrading the system? How do you make sure like somebody hasn't, hacked into your system or what? Like, there's a whole lot of extra stuff beyond just like getting it running, which we know as developers, like, once you've gotten it running, like, that's, maybe half the battle. I don't know, like, tests and refactoring it and making it understandable and counting it and documenting it. And
I think the test for me is that it's not enough that you can deploy your application. You have to be able to redeploy it on fresh architecture.
Right.
And if you can't redeploy it on fresh architecture with the same ease, or, it's going to take a bit longer because you've got to, spin up the new whatever. But that's the test. Can you redeploy it? And if you can, then you're in a good place.
For sure. I want to hear about Button a little.
Well, it's so similar. I don't, targeting a smaller scale thing. I'm looking at helping individual developers who, they want to get their app online. It's more about so I'm building a native Mac app, and a native app where you can enter your variables and enter your secrets, so they're being coded in the app, and then it'll launch it and get it into the right place for you with those environment variables populated, so that you don't, that difficulty that people have where they're committing secrets to the repo and they don't know how to, they don't know how to manage that. And so it's more targeting that layer rather than spinning up an ECS cluster, which I think is a bit too much for the kind of user I've got in mind.
Absolutely.
But it's the same. The underlying motivation is the same, exactly the same, is that to stick something on AWS, that's the right place to put it for me. But you don't want to have to deal with all of that nonsense just to configure basically a correct AWS environment. And the thing you said that's 100% correct is that 90% of people are going to do it exactly the same way every single time. And it's that 90%, fine. And for me, with Button, I'm out straight up saying, look, if you're already into containers and Kubernetes, or you know all this stuff, then Button's not for you. It's Button's for I've written my first Django app. How on earth do I get it online?
Yeah, I think that's the test. If you can, for whoever solves this problem, to take the Polls app and put that up the easiest. you know, because that's for someone new, that's what they want. But, you know, the docs isn't going to do that because Django itself doesn't do that. And, you know, and in some ways, it's like the early framework Scrum, right, where Django is one of many Python-based frameworks. So hopefully there'll be multiple ones that sit between learning AWS and Heroku. This certainly seems like there's plenty of room.
Yeah, I think
No, I mean, I think there really is. Like, there's the you can't possibly serve. You know, I could, you know, if I worked on Button for the next decade, I could cover like half of the territory with features, and it would be bloated and unusable. It would be exactly the thing I'm trying to provide a solution for. And so I can target one niche, and P can target another one, and Amazon's up there going, look, we're basically talking to infrastructure engineers, and if you're not one of them, we don't want to talk to you. And so, well, most people who want to deploy an app, they're not infrastructure engineers.
I did have like the thought of like, Amazon could come by and like eat our lunch, and you know
they don't care. Day. It's not worth it.
But I think. You know, I've seen the stuff like they've got LightSail, which is supposed to be like an easier way to do some of this stuff. And there's a project out there called Copilot, which is supposed to make ECS a little easier to work with. And like, I still think it's just like it's too far off from where people want to be with that. I posted an example on Twitter the other day. So I was, you know, part of what we do is like set up a load balancer for people and add a certificate. So it's got, you know, TLS and all that. And I was updating that. So you get logs from your load balancer because that's something people want, you know. And it was when I finished building it all out, it was 10,000 characters of JSON for CloudFormation to. You know, you have to set up, it gets logged to an S3 bucket. You have to set up your S3 bucket. You have to set all these like arcane IAM policies to allow the load balancer to talk to the S3 bucket. If you want to be able to like tear it down quickly, then you need to write custom code to empty all the files out of your S3 bucket before you delete it. You need to write like special stuff. So by default, it'll just keep filling up your S3 bucket. Like S3 is cheap, but you don't want to keep logs for, you know, 5 years. So you need like a custom rule to delete old logs. And like, there's just, it's so much there. It's mind boggling to something you would expect. Like, this seems like it should be like a line or two, you know, like, yeah, I want logging, you know, like that should be easy, but it's not.
I just don't see how. Like you describing creating that thing, it's like how I have this thing now, and where I was working on Button from DjangoCon 2019, and I was doing really well until COVID arrived, and then it just ground to a halt. And at the end of the year, I was looking at my diary and I was saying, do you know what, I actually didn't make any progress from the whole time COVID hit till the end of the year. And I said, talking to my wife, I said, well, you know, I've got to find some time. So I've got this Button Saturday, Saturday morning, where I can sit and work on it. And my Button Saturday is just like creating these, you know, these rules, where it's putting them all together so other people don't have to. It's smiling at that. But Amazon have no interest in making that easy for people.
Well, I think they're you know, they're in the selling picks and shovels business, right? Like you can put it together however you want. You've got tons of flexibility. Like there's certainly value in that, but it gears it to a very specific user, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I think, and especially to have a framework specific solution. So Django, you know, even Heroku could be a lot better with how it describes Django. Like its docs are pretty out of date. I know the sort of Django overlord they've had has changed a couple times over the years. So, you know, even Heroku doesn't have a simple story for Django. So just as a, you know, just like Stripe started off as payments for developers and now it's for everyone, you know, it seems like that's a nice logical progression for a hosting platform too. Like if you can nail the Django piece, because it is, I mean, Heroku, Python Anywhere, I guess there's Replit, you know, there's just such a chasm to spending the time that the two of you are doing, which most people don't know how to do or don't want to do. So,
we're not touching it right now, but yeah, like, do you use Gunicorn or UWSGI or ASGI or WSGI or Uvicorn or you know, how do you store files? Like, oh, you need Django storages to do that. And, you know, how do I like use DJ database URL to, yep. like, there's all this kind of knowledge that we have having done this before, that coming in as a new person is, even that's like, just that part's overwhelming. Just getting I gave a DjangoCon talk on this, that was like prepping your project for production. Like it's a big deal. It's a big difference between getting something running on localhost versus getting it running elsewhere. Just even without all the, how do you do deployment stuff, just getting your code ready.
Yeah, but to cut back to your where you started, like, okay, so you're going to deploy your app, and then you think, oh, I need email. I need to send, you know, password right. reset. So, oh God, I've got to set up my domain for email, and I've got to verify the domain and do those funny DK whatever the yeah. Jobber yeah. thing records. And
yeah, how many people are doing it with probably their Gmail password for their personal account, you know, as their email credentials?
Yeah, but Google even stopped you doing that now. It's like, they stopped. I've got to do OAuth.
Yeah. They used to be able, like, 4 or 5 years ago, you could do that. Well, and then even if you say, I'm going to build like a really, really basic Django site and show you how to do it, well, I need to show you email. And, you know, SendGrid last year changed something major. So, you know, so it's like when I first built the first editions of my books, because like on version 5 for them, I had, you know, all these other services I would use. And now I'm just like really trying to strip everything away because they change so much and, you know, beyond the control. And yet, you know, as a jobbing developer, that's what you have to do, is keep up to date with these things. So anything that can be hosted and out of sight, out of mind, it's like, take the money. I don't want to deal with it.
For sure.
So can people, there's a wait list, right? So people should sign, is that the action item for people listening? Go to appack.io.
Yeah, that would be great. So I probably will start emailing some folks on that in the next week or two. I'm trying to keep it really small, just to kind of get feedback and polish the experience. I'm taking the, is it Reid Hoffman, or, you know, if you're not embarrassed of your first version, you waited too long to launch.
Yeah, that's
so
perfect.
It works. There's, you know, there's rough edges, but I'm guessing a lot of people probably wouldn't, you know, I know because I can peek behind the curtains, but a lot of people hopefully wouldn't even notice it. We're kind of trickling people in right now, and hoping that we get enough kind of feedback from that to do a larger public launch.
Super.
That sounds great. But is there anything we've missed that we haven't covered that you want to mention to folks?
I don't have much. I think you hit it all. You know, like I said, Lincoln Loop, we're still doing, you know, Django consulting and helping folks with either build Django sites, maintain them, support them, all that. And AppPack's kind of been my personal project over the last few months. And look for the high performance Django stuff online soon. And
yep.
That's what we've got going on.
Super.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I know we've long wanted to have you on, so thank you for accepting.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks so much for reaching out. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on.
So as ever, we are Chat Django on Twitter, djangochat.com, and we'll see everyone in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Join us next time.